This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. This hour, it's our annual review of the science stories that made news this year and maybe a few things that we missed. There were the exciting discoveries like water on the moon, lots of it. The unveiling of a fossil nicknamed Artie, one of our distant ancestors older than Lucy. The year saw technology innovations like more efficient solar cells and social networking like Twitter and Facebook came into their own. And we all know science wouldn't be nearly as fun if scientists didn't fight amongst themselves. There was plenty of scientific debate this year. The new mammogram guidelines, who should get screened, at what age, a dispute about some old dinosaur bones, and whom to vaccinate and when with the swine flu vaccine. Also, not to leave out healthcare debate. So we've assembled a roundtable of science writers and editors to tell us what they thought of this year's science news and where we might see some of these debates going in the future. We can't take any calls today, but if you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topics. Let me introduce my guests. Paul Rayburn is the biology and medical writer for the Knight Science Journalism Tracker. He's here in New York, and now for his new book, Why Fathers Matter, that will be out next year. He joins us, as I say, in our studios in New York. Welcome back, Paul.
Thanks, Ira. Nice to be here.
Good to have you. Mayra DeCristina is the newly minted editor-in-chief of Scientific American and Scientific American Mind here in New York. She is also the president of the August National Association of Science Writers, which I'm a member. She's here with us in New York. Welcome to the program, Marianne.
Thanks so much, Ira.
Nicholas Thompson, Nick to his friends, is a senior editor at Wired here in New York. He's also the author of The Hawk and the Dove, Paul Nitze, George Kennan, and the History of the Cold War. And he's here in our New York Bureau. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much, Ira.
Phil Plait writes Discover Magazine's Bad Astronomy blog. He's also the author of Death from the Skies, These Are the Ways the World Will End. Ooh. He joins us from Coop Studios in Boulder, Colorado. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Plait.
Thank you, Ira.
Since you're out there in Colorado, Phil, let me ask you to begin and tell us what you thought perhaps the major science story or what science story interested you the most this year.
Well, I'm biased. I'm an astronomer. I like all science, but astronomy is my thing. And so I was really thrilled about the discovery of water on the moon. Mm. And this has been a long time coming. The idea was that they had taken some data from craters deep on the poles of the moon where sunlight never reaches, and they got some tantalizing hints there might be water there. And this was over a decade ago. Several space probes have been smashed into these craters hoping to dislodge that water. And then finally, this year, the LCROSS, which is a NASA probe, slammed into the floor of the crater Cabeus, sent up a plume, and inside of that plume, they detected water, which indicates that there is a lot of ice frozen in the bottom of these craters.
Do we know how much water is on the rest of the moon, though? Is it all locked up in these dark spots, do you think?
Well, there's certainly quite a bit there, enough to do something with if you were to, say, put a colony there. Another study was released shortly before the LCROSS impact, which found water all over the moon, which was also fascinating. But that's in very, very, very low quantities, not enough to be able to do anything with. That's more of an interesting scientific result. But finding the ice in the bottom of the crater was clearly something NASA wants because they're interested in colonizing the moon.
They had a public relations snafu on that, didn't they? They sort of put out this video that
was... Well, this was supposed to be, I mean, Phil can correct me here, but I think this was supposed to be a great event for amateur astronomers and observational astronomy. We were all going to look up and see the water flying off the moon, and that didn't happen. Isn't that right, Phil?
Well, when you impact something at this speed and with this mass, you get a flash of light, and they were hoping that the plume would extend up high enough that people on the ground could see it here on Earth. And it didn't work out that way. And that's too bad. And they probably should have stressed and said, listen, we're trying to do this. It's not guaranteed. And what happened was people were really expecting this thing to be really, really spectacular. And basically nothing was seen from the ground. But the bottom line is that they did find all this water. And that's what's important.
When you put out a video that everybody picks up, even though it's an animation of what to expect and the whole world is putting it virally on the internet and all the news channels are picking it up, big splash is going to happen, and it doesn't happen. That's a lesson to be learned there.
You know, I could actually segue from that right into things that I wanted talk about, if that's okay.
Yes, please.
And it has to do with sort of public messages. If you look at so I spent a lot of my time covering medicine and biology and that sort of thing. And if you look at some of the big stories, the story, recent story on mammography screening, what are we supposed to do, cervical cancer screening. Right after that, the whole complications over the swine flu vaccine and even the AIDS vaccine in Thailand, the common denominator in all these important stories from the year was that the public health messages got completely screwed up. The public doesn't quite know what to think about any of these things. Did the AIDS vaccine in Thailand, the experiment in Thailand, did it work or not? You know, it worked partially. So was that, you know, and we get very mixed message from different authorities about whether that was a success or not. I'm sure I don't have to tell most listeners about the mammography screening mess. I defy any woman between 40 and 50 to tell me what clear message she got from all that massive amount of coverage. And I think the truth is there just isn't enough evidence out there to be able to tell 40-year-old women what to do. But that's not what we heard. We heard from all kinds of different sources very clear messages about what they should do, the Cancer Society and the National Cancer Institute saying different things. And so it turned out to be a mess. And I think there's probably a little part of that in which journalists are responsible for not pressing harder and trying to clarify it. But mostly, I would say the big story in that arena of 2009 was more or less the collapse of public health efforts on various fronts.
Mariette, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point that Paul is making. I remember myself when I was only in my 30s and my doctor was starting to encourage me to go and get a mammogram at that time. And I remember the earlier recommendations, which, by the way, let's all remind ourselves that in earlier days, we didn't recommend mammograms, for one thing, to be done as early as they have been done for the past 10 years. And so I myself, I'm admittedly in a better position than many people to be comfortable with waiting a little bit, decided to wait a little bit, don't have a family history of breast cancer, and luckily enough can read those comparative medicine responses and see how they work. But I agree. For the public, it's very hard if the message isn't clear. Ira, to your point earlier, if you put out a video and it looks like there'll be a big explosion of light, that's what we expect. And if doctors who we are raised to trust tell us it's this today and tomorrow tell us something else, it's really hard for people to adapt to changing messages like that.
How much
blame do we give to the Obama administration? I think this is actually a very interesting question here, in that Obama came in and the thought was, well, under Bush, the scientists served the politicians. The politicians said we wanted to come out this way. And Obama comes in and it was supposed to be reversed. The scientists would say do it this way and the politicians would follow. With the mammogram study, the scientists come out and say we have new recommendations. We used to say this. Now we say this. Then there's public outrage. Congress say the death panels. All these horrible things are said. And instead of the Obama administration saying, no, wait a second. We've had this independent panel. They've made their judgments. What happened was Obama backed away. Now, is this a bad sign? What do we take of this about how the president is actually changing the culture of science? Is it a small part in a much larger trend, or was it such a complicated issue we shouldn't blame them at all? What would you say?
Well, I don't think it was really an issue about I don't think it was an issue about the culture of science. I think it was an issue about delivering the message. And so these folks who developed these recommendations in the Health and Human Services Department have been at work at this, as you know, for a few years, and they just happened to be finished and come out this year. The problem was, there wasn't sufficient coordination, for one thing, among the various parts of the federal government so that there was a single message. But they apparently didn't even notify the American Cancer Society, which has an interest in this and has huge, you know, following in the public and respect, with what the findings were going to be and work out a consistent message ahead of time. Now, we don't want these people to get together and conspire, and then later have their emails uncovered and it'll look like, mammogram gate, like the climate situation. We don't want to think they're behind closed doors, you know, messing around with the data. But we do want them to kind of come to some sort of consensus on the data and the limitations of what they can recommend and so forth, so that when they finally say something to the public, you know, people can figure out what to do. Mm-hmm. Or if they have nothing to say, look, we just don't know for women in their 40s.
Yeah. You know, we even had, I remember watching the evening news, we even had conflicting recommendations from the two doctors on one newscast. Did you see that?
I don't know if I saw. I didn't see that particular newscast, but one thing that did strike me through all this was at the end of every article it would say, but ask your doctor. Meanwhile, the poor doctors are also following this and thinking, what am I going to recommend to my patients? Yeah.
You know, I actually did a post on the Night Tracker on exactly that thing, which is to argue, you know, to take a bit of an extreme view, to argue that, you know, how many times have we all written, you know, for more on this, consult your doctor before you do or do not take this medicine, et cetera. And it's kind of a reporter's cop-out. You know, mm-hmm. doctors, I mean, I had a conversation with a doctor a couple of years ago. She says, why do you keep sending people to us? We know less than you do about it. You know, I mean, when it comes out, we don't know what to tell them. And I think reporters should press a little harder. That's a standard response from these people. Tell them to ask their doctors. Not good enough, really. Mm-hmm.
Nick, did you
in this case, we also have four different parties involved. You have scientists who, you know, honestly, as a scientist myself, are not always the best at disseminating information in such a way that the public can understand it. We've got the media trying to report this and trying to make a story. The government is involved, and who knows where they're going to go with anything. And then the fourth party is the public, who are trying to make the best of this information, and they're getting it filtered through all of these different accounts. And so it's very difficult for them to make a decision, especially when they're hearing conflicting data all the time from scientists and the media.
And there are some people who don't believe anything the government says. I mean, that really, you know, we had a listener on Science Friday when we were talking about vaccinations and does it cause side effects and I'm not going to get my kid vaccinated. And I remember distinctly we had a debate going on and I interviewed her for 10 minutes and people were upset that I spent so much time with this one listener. But she was very interested and interesting because I said to her, is there anything any data, any amount that we can give you that you will change your mind? And she said, no, I don't believe anything from anybody that I hear anymore.
Well, and that would be a good reason for a journalist writing about vaccines to say, at the end, ask your doctor, because overall, doctors are going to know a lot more about the question of whether you should get vaccinated than the average journalist. And one thing, you know, the vaccine debate is a great example where there are people who have written very long articles about why you shouldn't vaccinate your kid, and they're very convincing, but the person has no authority and has no training and actually doesn't know a whole lot about the subject. But on the internet, nobody knows you're not a doctor.
Yeah. And she wouldn't even listen to her doctor either. So this
sounds like this was the issue of the childhood vaccines.
Yeah, it's exactly what
it's carried right over to swine flu this year.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about the other stories this year of Paul Rayburn, Marriott, the Christina, Nicholas Thompson, and Phil Plait. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News. This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. This year, it's our roundtable chat about science stories with my panelists, my guest, Paul Rayburn, biology and medical writer for the Night Science Journalism Tracker, Marietta DeChristina, newly minted editor, as I say, and chief of Scientific American and Scientific American Mind here in New York, Nick Thompson, senior editor at Wired, also author of The Hawk and the Dove, Paul Nitze, George Kennan, and the History of the Cold War. Phil Plait writes Discover Magazine's Bad Astronomy blog. He's also the author of Death from the Skies. These are the ways the world will end. We can't take any calls today, but if you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me begin with you, Nick. Let's talk about an interesting development online this year, real-time searching, learning what people are talking about right now. We saw Twitter going on. I mean, it just blew up this year, did it not?
Yeah, Twitter is on absolutely everything. We did a very fun experiment at Wired Magazine where a writer named Evan Ratliff wrote a story about how people disappear and what does it take to change your identity and become somebody new. After that story ran, we ran an experiment where he went on the run for a month. We said to Wired readers, if you can track him down, you get $5,000. If he can last a month, he gets $5,000. And what turned out is there was this incredible conversation on Twitter, a conversation that couldn't have happened 6 months ago, where somebody would say, I think he's doing this. Somebody else would post, I think he's doing that. I think he's doing this. And you had thousands and thousands of people in this incredible, immediate conversation trying to track him down, which eventually they did. But it was a very interesting experiment, both in what privacy means today, what identity means today, and then also the way conversation is changing and what's possible now that wasn't possible recently.
Do you think Twitter is a fad?
No.
Twitter,
the company, might be a fad. Twitter, the company, might be gone in 2 years. Who knows? I mean, they're not making a whole lot of money. Somebody might have a better idea. These things come and go. Mm-hmm. But the idea of immediate communication where I post what I'm doing or what I'm thinking and a select group of people read it, that's definitely going to be here for quite a while.
But there's no money being made on it.
There's no money being made on it
right
now.
But commercially, that's what drives business, isn't
it? Right, but Twitter also doesn't have a whole lot of infrastructure costs. You just need some servers and a little bit of code and a few people to maintain it. Somebody is going to be able to monetize it. Facebook is using it. They've basically built Twitter into Facebook. So this technology will be there for a while.
Marriott?
I was just thinking of the news story that I just saw about at least some people have figured out how to make money off Twitter and Facebook, for that matter, by sending junk mail ads. come, invest in whatever.
Yeah, well, I get a lot of Twitter invitations that aren't suitable for family radio, I have to tell you. I'm not sure how they're finding me.
Well, one funny thing is the way they were able to catch Evan Ratliff is somebody followed his fake Twitter account in the guise of a webcam girl so that he would think it was a spammer, not a tracker. And so he didn't know that people were onto him.
Do you think there's an age group that Twitters more than – or tweets more than any other age group?
Absolutely. It's the 20s and 30-year-olds. You know, the 40 and 50-year-olds aren't as comfortable with this technology, and the teenagers think it's lame. So it's a very funny, small demographic that uses it.
It's interesting because you're right. Teenagers are just there IMing.
They've got all sorts of other stuff they've got IMing.
And people don't want to go through, I have to set this up, I have to work on that. These kids just want to do the instant stuff.
Right, and so when they're in their 20s and 30s, they'll be doing something else.
It's not that hard. I'm live tweeting this right now.
What did I say? Oh, no.
Don't discount the idea of this as a marketing tool as well. Adam Savage from MythBusters was having a problem with his phone carrier, I won't name any names, and tweeted about it because he was getting static from his phone carrier, pardon the pun, and they flooded this carrier with lots of email, and sure enough, he got a phone call, and his problems got fixed very rapidly. So Twitter as a marketing tool and as a tool for social change, it's very strong.
We actually had a very interesting case of that on Science Friday. We were on a remote in a university, and we were setting up on the stage to do the show from there, and we got a tweet from the audience that said, "Can you move that plant that's in the way?" Which we did, you know. Yeah. But I'm just wondering whether is there a next generation of this, or you mentioned something about facial webcams, and now we seem to see that facial recognition. Mm-hmm. Is making an inroad into the internet, which to me is a scary thing. Does it scare you as much as it scares me?
I think facial recognition is definitely one of the more complicated and scary technologies that's coming. Fortunately, it's not working as well as many people say it is, but it's getting better and better and will be working in a few years, at which point we have all sorts of moral and ethical questions we have to answer, similar questions that have been raised as we've suddenly got cameras in every street corner in New York.
But the problem you're talking about is facial recognition of any of us walking along the street, that sort of thing?
Where's Paul right now? You know, I put it out on my Twitter feed. You know, I've lost him, and, you know, somehow there's a camera feed, and they identify it, and they know that you're on, 63rd and Broadway. You just walked into a coffee shop.
Yeah.
Or worse.
I mean, isn't one of the trade-offs?
I hope that's where I was going.
Isn't one of the trade-offs of all these social media and things that bring us together is that they bring us together.
Right.
And it's once we're brought together, it's kind of hard to escape.
Right. The people, it brings your distant friends closer and it makes your close friends more distant because suddenly you're wrapped up in those, frivolous conversations with 1,000 people instead of intense conversations with 3 people.
You know, we used to, 10 years ago or longer when I was at Business Week, we used to talk about protecting privacy, or at least some of the people there. And several of us who thought we were the most sophisticated type say, forget it. Privacy's gone. There's nothing to protect. It's out there. It's too late. And I still think that. And I think that's sort of a prudent attitude to take. But hearing about this facial recognition, you keep hearing about these things, or the invasion of privacy is gone beyond, or continues to go beyond anything we could imagine.
Well, the two things are
viruses and other biologicals change over time, and then we can figure out ways to combat them. Did it change the country on a huge national scale? Hard to say. I think this is Darwin himself took many years to come to grips with what he himself discovered and found. It took him a long time. Many people have written about this or spoken about it to actually print those findings that he had, because he grappled with it too. His wife was very religious. He, came from a religious society.
Yeah.
And let's face it, it was quite different from what everybody had thought was true.
And I also saw for the first time some publications of Wallace's papers that probably would not have come out had it not been for this anniversary.
Right. And of course, we have this this other, the name is now escaping me. Ira, you said you forget everything, and so do I.
Well, it goes with the age.
You'll
think of it 20 minutes from now.
I will. Well, you know, now that the Origin of the Species is out of the copyright realm, it can be printed. It was recently printed with a foreword in it critiquing right. all of the Origin of the Species. So I guess we have to expect that, too. My point
that
is...
That was Ray Comfort and Kurt Cameron.
Thank you so much.
Good for Phil.
Thank you, Phil.
Phil saves us.
If it's anti-science, I'm on top of it. These guys made fools of themselves by adding about 50 pages of creationist nonsense to the beginning of Origin of Species and handing it out college campuses.
Hmm. To me, if there can be said to be a benefit here, it's that at least we're talking about it, because when we stop talking, that's when we fail.
Yeah, I despair a little bit of ever seeing any real consensus or coming together of these different worldviews. You know, I just I think it's very discouraging that, you know, how much science do you need? How much evidence do you need, you know, to try to persuade people and to also persuade people that it's possible to be both religious and also acknowledge the facts of the world we live in. It's very troubling, I think.
Well, it is troubling, Paul. And as Ira said before about the woman who would go to the doctor and not even believe
right.
the doctor,
right.
some of us are just going to be doubters. That's maybe our job, actually, some of us, to ask questions of things.
But
it's when they get the vast majority of opinion that it is upsetting.
But the vaccine one is very interesting because on evolution, I mean, you two and I, we don't have a whole lot of friends or people we know who don't believe in evolution. I mean, that debate is sort of settled, and a large percentage of the country believes one thing and a certain set of the country believes another thing, and they're sort of different groups. The vaccine debate is interesting because there are all sorts of people who I know and who I'm connected with in my world who believe you shouldn't vaccinate your children, and where the mountain of scientific evidence hasn't affected them at all. And so it's almost another front in the war against science, and it's a front that has opened in places where the evolution battle has not been fought.
Well, here's an interesting piece. It's not our fault on the journalism side, but again, on the sort of public health side, a lot of people who refused to get swine flu vaccine were health workers, nurses, and people who worked in hospitals. Now, what was that about?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never did understand that. If we can't count on those people to live by the precepts and what's been found, it's mm-hmm. it's a bigger problem in some ways. Mm-hmm.
Talking about the year review this hour on Science Friday from NPR News. And, of course, you could say the same thing about global warming. You know, why is global warming a political issue? I mean, I know when it started, I think. I started with Ronald Reagan ripping the solar panels off the White House. But at least that's what I remember watching it happen, you know. But these things that should be just talked about, we have now become polarized in just about every scientific issue. You'll find a huge numbers of people on both sides.
I mean, this is the tragedy of the emails, is that it's made the debate. It used to be, you could look at the debate, step back and say, okay, there's one side that really presents the scientific evidence. There's another side that sort of denies it. That the scientific question is kind of settled, and there's sort of good guys and bad guys. There are very complicated questions around what we should
right.
do about it, and those are hard. But now with the release of these emails, you see that there's a politicization on the side of the scientists who actually really look at the data, and that's going to sort of – the debate was hard enough already and hard yeah. enough to actually get to solutions and figure out what to do, and this has just made it
all right,
worse.
Let me move on a little bit because we're getting into everything. Phil, let's talk about – we're talking about anniversaries, a 400-year anniversary, but this is also Galileo's telescope. Anniversary too, isn't it?
Right. It's the 150th anniversary of the publication of Origin of Species, but that's, of course, a squishy science, as I call it. That's biology.
Spoken like a
really
physicist.
Cool stuff. Yeah, right.
Zing.
Of course. Yeah, there we go. But in fact, it's also the International Year of Astronomy. It's the 400th anniversary of Galileo pointing his telescope to the sky and starting to record his observations. It's not the 400th anniversary of the invention of the telescope. That actually is sort of lost in history a little bit. And Galileo wasn't even the first person to use it on the sky or even to draw something. There were drawings of the moon that were done earlier than his, but he is the one who basically self-promoted enough that we remember him four centuries later. And it's been a very big year. There's been an international push to make astronomy a lot more public. There's been more news items. There have been a lot of citizen science projects where people can contribute to astronomy. And it's really been fantastic to see everybody participating the way they have.
Mm-hmm. It was also a big year for the Hubble Space Telescope.
Oh, terrific. Yeah. I've been a fan of Hubble since it launched. I actually worked on Hubble, signed onto it to work on my PhD right before it launched. Then it launched and all the pictures were fuzzy, and that was a fun year, I'll tell you that much. But it was designed to go into low Earth orbit and be periodically upgraded as parts wore out and as technology got better. Well, in May of this year, of 2009, the space shuttle Atlantis went to Hubble, put in two new cameras, replaced two that had gone on the fritz, basically, upgraded gyroscopes and all sorts of computer parts, and now we have what is essentially a renovated and reinvigorated Hubble Space Telescope, and it's already returning just devastating pictures of the sky.
Mm-hmm. And how long could it last for, now that it's been renovated?
Well, you know, it could go for 5 years or more. It really depends mostly on the gyroscopes, which are used to stabilize it, point it, and move it. And it could last for five more years. Of course, it could go on the fritz tonight. You never know. These sorts of things can be touchy. I'm hoping it'll last for several more years. And its orbit changes. It eventually gets lower in Earth's orbit. Eventually, it will burn up, and there's not much we can do about that, I don't think, unless private space industry takes up that call.
And they would find some reason to do that.
Well, I hope so. There's always a public debate when it comes to what should we do with Hubble. Should we bring it back to Earth? Should we let it burn up? Should we boost it to a higher orbit and let it go on forever? And the problem with that is it costs money, and we've got other telescopes mm-hmm. with better technology we want to put up there. You have to draw that line someplace.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to draw the line at taking a break right now because we have to pay the bills. So we're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more with Paul Rayburn, Marietta Christina, Nick Thompson, and Phil Plait. Stay with us. We'll be right back talking about the great and not-so-great science stories of the year. Maybe we'll get into some science stories that fizzled this year. So we'll be right back. Stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News. This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the good, the bad, and the ugly, you might phrase it, in science stories this year with my guest Paul Rayburn, biology and medical writer for the Knight Science Journalism Tracker here in New York, Marietta Christina, who is editor-in-chief of Scientific American and Scientific American Mind here also in the city, Nicholas Thompson, senior editor at Wired, also author of The Hawk and the Dove, Paul Nitze, George Kennan, and the History of the Cold War. Phil Plait writes Discover Magazine's Bad Astronomy blog. He's also the author of Death from the Skies. These are the ways the world will end. What's next on your list, Paul, that you thought was a big thing?
Well, there were some gene therapy advances this year, and of course, this is gene therapy is, how do we say this? This is the coming advance that's always coming, the
right.
treatment of the future that's always like, in the future.
It's like right. fusion. Yeah.
It's right. Like
yeah,
fusion, right.
Yeah, exactly. You know.
It's always 30 years away.
Yeah, and so the disease this year was something, if I can say this without stumbling, adrenoleukodystrophy, I think.
Very good.
Just two children, fatal brain disease, given gene therapy, seem to be doing better. You know, so just a little pilot, a little tiny thing, but a glimmer that maybe they're getting there. This is probably the best example yet of something actually appearing to work. Now, the notable point is that this was a very small experiment with the two children, and we've been promised gene therapy for about 30 years now, since the
right.
first genes were identified, and people said, hey, this is easy. Now all we have to do is fix them. And there's a checkered, talk about the good, bad, and the ugly. There was a famous case 10 years ago now, I was surprised to find when I checked this, Jesse Gelsinger at University of Pennsylvania, who was an early pioneer patient who died within a few days of receiving gene therapy. It turned out to be a huge, complicated story. It was a disorder, a disorder had to do with nitrogen processing. Mm-hmm. I don't know the name mm-hmm. of it. But there were allegations. The Washington Post right. did a big investigative right. thing. Did the researcher, was he improper behavior and so forth? So that slowed things down. There was a treatment a few years ago in France of a few children with this combined immunodeficiency disorder that has been in the news before, seemed to work. And then not long after, one of the children got a leukemia-like mm-hmm. illness, a side effect that people worried about, and there it was. So we're still not there with gene therapy, but this is an encouraging story this year, and maybe people can figure this out. This is the kind of medicine we want to have, where we can just go in very meticulously, fix the target exactly where the problem is, and leave everything alone. But it's proving to be conceptually fairly simple, in practice extremely difficult.
And one of the problems with that is if you go in for gene therapy, you have to get all the gene. You have to get all the cells with the genes in them.
That's the trick, right? So they use a virus to infect your cells with the new gene, and that's where it gets tricky, because those viruses can also interfere with the genome in a way that might lead to cancer or might lead to other problems.
Nick, lots of science arguments this year. One of the classic fights in science over data, who's right, who's wrong, was a really big clash over some T-Rex fossils.
This is an amazing story. So these T-Rex fossils are dug up and sent back to this researcher at Harvard. They grind up, look in the lab, and they say, look, we've analyzed it and we found proteins. And it's a big study. It comes out, I think, in 2007. Scientific community says, wait a second. A bunch of people look at the data and say, you're totally wrong. This is a guy who's inflated what he's found. He doesn't actually know how to do math. You know, lots of science become more mathematically based. So one way to shoot down a researcher is say they don't really know what they're doing mathematically. So the studies are kind of rejected and pushed aside. Look, this guy's just wrong. And all these people come out against him. And it's made particularly prominent because it's a story about T-Rex, so everybody wants to read it. So the theory is that the story was blown out of proportion by journalists, and the original researcher probably blew it out of proportion because it was T-Rex and he knew it would be a big hit. But then he actually comes back and he does a little more work, and he refutes all the refutations. So he puts out another paper that comes out in April or May, this guy John Assar at Harvard, and suddenly it looks like, wait a second, they did actually find proteins in these bones. And it's this incredible reversal. And you know, we followed it at Wired Magazine. We assigned a story on it. And when we assigned the original story on it, it was going to be, you know, exposing the fraud and the wrong math that went into this study. You know, we've got, you know, all this evidence that this is totally wrong. And we're looking into it. Wait a second. He's right. And it was an amazing twist and turns to a great, great story. So from a narrative perspective, that's one of the most fascinating ones of the year.
That's interesting. Because you're right. It was a great story in itself about how science operates.
And it's about T-Rex. I mean, my God, what could be better than it wasn't about some goldfish or something?
Yeah, I guess it's sort of the biggest story since they put the wrong head on the dinosaur. That sort of thing. Phil, new topic for you. Let's talk about a little success this year, the partial success, the Large Hadron Collider. Yeah. They got some protons smashing into each other finally.
That's been an interesting story for quite some time. I mean, this is probably the most complicated, expensive, and biggest scientific experiment ever built. And so you don't expect it to get snapped together like, you know, putting batteries into a flashlight and turn it on and it works. And there were some problems. They had an issue last year where there was a magnetic problem which leaked coolant helium, and they had to shut everything down and go down in there and fix it. And as they were starting it back up, there were some other problems. Evidently, there was a bird that dropped some bread outside.
It was a baguette dropped in.
Yeah. and then there was the paper, and this one killed me, the paper that came out saying, perhaps the universe itself is trying to keep the Large Hadron Collider from starting up.
Yeah,
and
go.
That information
some version
from
of the
future,
Gaia hypothesis.
The information from the future is coming backwards in time. And, you know, I had that paper sitting on my computer for months. And if I thought it was going to be that big of a story, I would have written about it in the beginning of the year. But I thought, well, this is just silly. And, of course, it turned into a huge story. But now, in fact, things are working pretty well. They're starting to increase the power. They recently broke a record for the most amount of energy they were able to inject into the proton streams as they're going spinning around this accelerator, which is underneath the border of Switzerland and France. They actually smashed protons together. They got data out. And things are looking really, really good for early next year of them going to full power, which is going to be fantastic. They're trying to find out one of the most fundamental questions in the universe, and that is, why do objects have mass? This is so obvious. I mean, we all have mass, but where does it come from? And they're trying to answer that. And I think that's phenomenal that we're trying to extend our knowledge into regions like this.
So full power is doomsday, Phil? Is that what you're telling us? You're the expert.
Oh, and there's the whole black hole, quark nugget thing. This plays into everything we've been talking about with anti-vaxxers and global warming deniers and creationists. There's a noise machine out there, and all they do is sow confusion and doubt. And all it the way we think, it's so easy to be thrown off the rails by something like that. And that really bugs me. These ClimateGate emails, these are not a big deal to me. These are just scientists who are being attacked and trying to figure out the best way to get the science out there. There's not been any faking of data or anything like that. And it's the same thing with the vaccines. It's the same thing with creationism and evolution. It's just noise. And we need to, you know, maybe the big story here is that scientists need to understand how to get the information out better so that the public can understand it. And this kind of noise can be, you know, I don't want to say suppressed, but at least minimized.
Well, you know, you got something in my head that just tweaked my – and one interesting part about this, that's something I want to bring up because we talked about it, not because Science Friday was involved, is that we're seeing some more of this. The way we're cutting through some of the noise and showing some public interest, we're seeing real science appearing on some of the popular TV shows. I mean, look at the Big Bang Theory. Even though I'm trying to toot our own horn because we were on, you know, the fact that they would call us up and ask Science Friday to come on the Big Bang Theory, which we did a few weeks ago. And everything that they talk about is real science. And to have a primetime show to be the most popular show in its genre on CBS, and they're talking about nerdy science.
Yeah, the geeks and the nerds.
It's hard to believe.
You know, one thing I love about that show, me too, Phil. I love that show, is they're showing the scientists as humans. And I think this directly connects to even to ClimateGate. You know, if the scientists are getting impatient with the constant, as you put it, Phil, the noise machine, which I agree, quite a noise machine here. Why is it surprising to us that scientists would, in an email, express extreme frustration when the Bush administration was rewriting climate information and putting it out? We just sort of shrugged our shoulders and said, oh, well, you know, why are we holding the scientists to some impossible human standard? Mm-hmm.
Talking about science on Science Friday this hour from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow here talking with our panel. To me, that's a really interesting move forward about having issues like they were talking about the Large Hadron Collider. They were talking about magnetic monopoles. They actually did a trip to the Arctic poles to show how scientists were working. They made silliness about it, but it made – and it got – one thing that struck me is that, you know, we're funded by the National Science Foundation, and we've talked to them all the time. But the NSF has been trying to get their name in front of the public for decades, And in one half hour, they were mentioned three or four times, the full name, in a popular TV show, which – I think it was more than the total sum of 40 years of trying to get their name out. They got it all there, you know. It just strikes me as a phenomenon of popularity of a show like this. And getting back to physics of what they talk about, one thing that struck me about the Large Hadron Collider discussion, and I've talked to many scientists about this, and maybe you can explain this a little bit, Phil, is you were talking about mass, and you're referring to the Higgs boson that they might want to find. But scientists are telling me we'd rather not find it. We'd be more excited
if we'd be more excited
if we didn't find it. Why is that?
I think it was Isaac Asimov, the scientist and science fiction writer, who said, you know, science doesn't progress by somebody looking into a microscope and yelling, "Eureka!" It's when they look into a microscope and say, "Hey, that's funny." And that's how this goes, right? Everybody expects the Higgs boson to be discovered, which is this particle which may be the reason objects have mass, that, you know, that I'm sitting here and not flying off into space at the speed of light. And everybody expects it so much. It's so much a part of the standard thought in particle physics that now people are saying it would be more interesting if it's not found. And the Higgs boson, the way the Large Hadron Collider is set up, when they smash these protons together at just a squeak in hair under the speed of light, they expect to be able to detect the signature of the Higgs boson. If it's not in there, that says something far more interesting about the universe as far as the standard model of particle physics goes. And that's what scientists live for. We want the answers. Of course we want the answers. You always want to put that last letter into the crossword puzzle or that last jigsaw piece in. But then you're done, and that's not fun. I mean, the journey is what's fun. And so, you know, you love it when something strange and weird and fantastic and wonderful happens, and because that means there are a bunch more questions that you need to search out and figure out what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just got a couple of minutes left. Any predictions of the future you think might come up? Any science breakthroughs that you might think might come out this year? Something to do with stem cells might give us some.
Well, that's another one that's been on the. That's another one that's
been
right in the future. The expansion of the stem cell lines under the Obama administration is certainly going to speed work in that regard. All of these things are going to work. Gene therapy is going to work. Stem cells are going to work. You know, medicine in 10 or 15 years is going to be quite different from what it is now. But if you're going to put a bet on a particular horse for next year, you're in trouble.
Well, I want to bet on one horse, maybe not for next year. There's a company called Archimedes that we just wrote about in Wired, and what they've done is they've built a complete model of the human body, and they're trying to test drugs. So if you want to test a diabetes drug, instead of having thousands of people measured over years, you can do certain variations of that test in silico. And this is something that whether or not this particular model works exactly as well as they say it does right now is an open debate. But I think in the future we are going to see a lot more of medicine being done through modeling the human body and working it on your computers.
I think that's probably right.
I think another big area for medicine is actually going to be, instead of worrying so much about solving problems after, emphasizing the health before. I mean, this has not been – this is something that even – we were talking about iPhones a little while ago. You can use your iPhone to get an app now. It can help you monitor your weight. It can help you monitor your heart rate, your hypertensive condition, and things like this. And we'll be able to – I think coming forward, we will have to have a more rational costing healthcare system, emphasize taking care of ourselves beforehand.
Phil, got anything you want to add?
Well, Ira, I think you're onto something when you're talking about scientists on television, and I think that this is something really important, and I think that in the next year or two, because we know that Hollywood is not the greatest innovator when it comes to new ideas, that when something works, you repeat it. And with Big Bang Theory and Fringe and Flash Forward and these other TV shows,
Numbers,
I think we're going to see – Numbers, it just goes on and on. Bones, I think we're going to see more science and more scientists portrayed realistically on TV and in the movies. And they're NSF and National Academy of Sciences have the Science and Entertainment Exchange, which is an effort to do that, to get Hollywood and scientists to communicate. And I think that that's what we're going to be seeing more of. And I love that because science is done by people. And that's something that we all need to remember.
All right. That's a great way to end it. I'd like to thank my guests this hour, Paul Rayburn, biology and medical writer for the Knight Science Journalism Tracker here in New York. Mariette DeCristina is editor-in-chief of Scientific American and Scientific American Mind. Nick Thompson, senior editor at Wired Magazine here in New York. And Phil Plait writes the Discover Magazine Bad Astronomy blog. He's also author of Death from the Skies. These are the ways the world will end. Thank you all for joining us today. Joining me now is Flora Lichtman, our video producer. Good to see you, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
Now, you usually have our video pick of the week, but we've got our video pick of the year.
Yeah, video pick of the year.
You must have a favorite. It's like asking, you know, what children of yours are favorite. It's hard to know.
It's hard. I like so many of them, but I do have a favorite, and it's mostly because the interview is great.
Which one is that?
It is the Mighty Water Bear video.
Ooh, explain which one that was.
So water bears are called, also known as tardigrades, and they are these little microscopic organisms that are so tough, you can't believe it. They've been, and researchers have realized this and have done crazy things with them, like deep frozen them.
No kidding.
And they come back to life.
Wow.
Sent them up in the vacuum of space, and they're fine. I mean, they really can withstand anything. And so this researcher at UNC, Bob Goldstein, is a tardigrade expert and also clearly admires them.
And you had a great video. It was up there on sciencefriday.com. That was a video pick of the week. And that's your favorite.
I think that's my top pick.
That's one of my top picks. They're so good, it's hard to pick. Candy corn in space that you did.
That is a fan favorite too.
Is that a fan favorite?
It is. I mean, it's amazing. This is just thank you for this footage because it is incredible.
They assembled candy corn up there in the space station.
Yep, up in the space station, and it's not just fun to watch. There is a scientific lesson. It's about how soap works. It's a demonstration of how soap works.
And they make this candy corn ball. It sticks together, and when it's all put together, you watch them put the pieces of candy corn in, and then it locks in.
Yeah, and the astronaut who did it actually said that he used the whole crew's supply.
All right. Well, we'll have our listeners vote on it. They can go and look at the video pick of the week, which becomes a video pick of the year. Tell us what you like. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks.
Our program is produced by Christopher Intagliata and senior producer Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman, our producer for digital media. Laura Pelcher, our SciArts producer. Shelley Du Bois is our Spanish language producer. Neil Rausch is our technical director. And Manoli Weatherall at the controls here in New York. We also had help in Second Life from Lynn Cullins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. If you'd like to write us, yes, please send your letters to Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Have a great new year. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.